Last time we talked about spectra. If there's anybody here, I'll start lecture. Okay. It's actually, there's been times when there's been no one here, and I still lecture. Okay. But we talked a little bit about different types of luminescent spectra that you could have, that you could generate. And I mentioned the excitation spectrum, and I talked a little bit about how it is related to the absorption spectrum. There's going to be any peak that's in the excitation spectrum, whether we're talking fluorescence excitation or phosphorescence excitation, that peak in the excitation spectrum must appear in the absorption spectrum because it has to absorb. The absorption is the excitation process. Now, there may be peaks missing from the excitation spectrum that are present in the absorption spectrum. All that means is there are certain absorptions that do not give rise to luminescence. And we'll discuss a little bit today about why that is. What happens? What happens to the energy? It went to the, well, I mentioned it already, I guess. What happens to that energy that's absorbed? In some cases, it gives rise to a non-radiative loss. So the energy doesn't return as luminescence, as light, but returns as heat, and that's primarily a non-radiative situation, or a collisional transfer of energy to some other species. So that's excitation spectrum. We talked about emission spectra, both fluorescence emission and phosphorescence emission. It's just emission of light. Fluorescence was a singlet process. Phosphorescence was a triplet process, but still emission, still light given off that came from the excited state. It's at a different wavelength. It's not scattering. Okay, so you might mistake scattering for emission, but scattering is at the same wavelength. Scattering is light comes in and is scattered off at the exact same wavelength as it came in. This is a true spectroscopic process where the light interacts with the matter. A process goes on inside of the matter. Excited state is generated. That excited state then decays and gives rise to an emission. Whether that's fluorescence or phosphorescence depends upon that singlet, triplet systems and whether or not there's any significant probability of the triplet system actually being attained. Then I talked to you, I gave you the example of phenanthrene, lots of things that give rise to these spectra, but not that many that you'd be able to record excitation, fluorescence, and a phosphorescence spectra, all of the same molecule in solution. Usually the phosphorescence is so long-lived that it's quenched by a collision. That's quite often the case. And of course, phosphorescence is not as common because of the low probability, the forbidden nature of the transition. So it's not as probable, not as likely to be observed as fluorescence. And fluorescence, all molecules don't fluoresce, only those that are, first of all, absorbed, and then second of all, are able to emit their radiation in a luminescence process as opposed to losing it non-radiatively or transferring it or colliding or something like that. Okay, so I mentioned all this about the wavelengths and the shift of the wavelengths. Sometimes it's referred to as a Stokes shift. That's technically a misnomer, but you'll see that used all the time. That there's a Stokes shift. Stokes shifts are more accurately in Raman spectroscopy and so forth. But at any rate, there's a shift. I mentioned a little bit here about the degree of structure in the fluorescence spectrum is due to the degree of solvation. The same as we talked about for absorption, or as I mentioned for absorption, and you should be looking at that lecture that I wasn't here for because that talks a lot about structure related to the light absorption. And here I'm going to mention just in a much lesser amount of detail the emission and how that relates to the structure. So I'll be talking about that in the next several minutes. But degree of structure in fluorescence is due to the degree of solvation. So we can start at the level of solvation. We're talking about molecular processes. We're talking about molecular absorption in the beginning of this section of the course, And so we're talking about solution phase, things that we can put into a cuvette. You can get molecular absorption in the gas phase. It's not commonly used. Just people don't use it analytically very much. But you can do it. You can do gas phase absorption of you know, of radiation, and look at things that way. And it is used for very specific things. Things like atmospheric pollutants. Ozone is measured often by a long path length absorption type cell, and some other species also. But most of the time we're talking about solutions. So we're talking, if we've got a solution, then we've got solvation. We've got the material is dissolved, and the solvent molecules are going to interact with the analyte molecule, the molecule that's undergoing the luminescence, the fluorescence, or whatever. And the amount of structure that we see is going to be related, first of all, to that amount of solvation and the interaction. If the molecule does not interact with the solvent molecules very much, then we'll see more structure. We'll see more of the inherent transitions that might give rise to pseudo-line spectra, you know, sharp bands. If there's a lot of interaction between the solvent and the analyte molecule, we're going to smear that out and lose a lot of that fine structure and get broad spectra. And that's often the case in solution. I said phenanthrene, because it's a rigid, flat molecule, doesn't interact much with the solvent. As a matter of fact, its solubility isn't very high. Okay, in most cases, there are some nonpolar solvents that you can get a significant amount of phenanthrene in, but its rigidity and its lack of interaction with the solvent molecules means that it gives a little more feature, a little more line character in the spectrum, and so we sort of, you know, we looked at these, you know, peaks, and a lot of features here in the spectrum. Okay. I mentioned the excitation emission matrix, the EEM, luminescence spectrum. That, and actually, you could do this for both. You could do this for phosphorescence, or you can see phosphorescence features in this spectrum as well as fluorescence spectrum, fluorescence features if they're present. If the phosphorescence is present, you'll see it. Why? Because all we're doing is we're taking all possible values of excitation and looking at all possible values of emission, and therefore we're going to see everything. And as a matter of fact, we're going to see some things that aren't even fluorescence. We're going to see some things that might even be, if I could remember the Raman bands. That doesn't look right. Well, maybe it is. This is low. Wait, this is kind of, it's tough getting graduate students to do the right thing. This isn't really plotted correctly. It's there's a convention for this, but here's a low wavelength of excitation, and here's the low wavelength for emission, and you'll see, you can see Raman bands. Okay, Raman spectroscopy. You can see the Raman bands for water quite often. If you have a good fluorescence spectrometer, you'll see Raman bands, but that's not fluorescence. That's not phosphorescence, but they show up. You'll see scattering. The scattering has been removed from this so that it wouldn't interfere with your ability to see the peak. But right along this line, okay, where is that the right line? It's where excitation and emission wavelengths are the same. Yeah, okay. So this would be 200, 200, and 300, 300, yeah. So along this line, where excitation and emission are the same, you'll see scattering bands. We said that when we talked about scattering, and I said a minute ago, it's the light of the same wavelength. Light comes in and is scattered in all directions, no change in wavelength. So if I'm doing fluorescence and I set my two monochromators, my excitation monochromator and my emission monochromator at the same wavelength, I see a scattering band. I see light scattered, and it's Rayleigh scattering, maybe, depending on whether it's the size of the molecule, you know, and we talked about those things, Rayleigh large particle scattering or whatever, but we see a large signal along that line where you have excitation and emission are the same. It's not fluorescence, it's not luminescence at all. So you got Raman, you got scattering, and then you got fluorescence and phosphorescence. So in the EEM, you can see everything. You see it all. Likewise, you can plot it as a contour, and we talked a little bit about that, looking at the peaks, okay, and just a different representation. And people get into a mode of looking at one versus the other. They like the picture of one versus the other. Yeah.
In the Raman scattering, why is it not fluorescence?
Because from the photophysics, we know, and again, I'll give you a couple of reasons how we know, ways in which we know, but remember, scattering was a virtual state. It's not, if you take the, I gave you two explanations of scattering. I gave you the quantum explanation, which creates a virtual state, not a real state. Virtual is, you know, make-believe, I don't know. It's non-reality, right? Did you ever go to a virtual reality? Anyway. Or the idea that it's, I probably like the wave explanation better, where you create a dipole in the molecule and that gives off the light of the same wavelength. Okay, so that's a different process than taking an electron and promoting it to a specific energy level from the energy level that it's normally in. Okay, the bond, you know, some a bonding electron in an orbital in a molecule and promoting that to some other energy level. Okay, that's a specific process related to absorption, and then that electron coming back down to the ground state, releasing its energy as light, that's fluorescence. Okay, and if it goes to triplet, it's phosphorescence, whatever. That's a different process than the scattering process, okay, where we're creating a dipole. Okay, the molecule, it's not electrons being promoted to different orbitals. They're staying in their same orbitals. They're just, it's like you're driving down the road and you're supposed to stay in the lanes, right? You're supposed to stay in the lanes. But if there's debris in the road, you move out of the lane to get around it, okay? You're still on the highway. You're still in the same lane, okay? It's that, so these electrons that are in a scattering situation, they don't leave their orbitals, okay? They're not going to an excited state orbital. So it's a different process. From the perspective of experimental chemistry, right, you may not care. You may not know what gives rise. We know now, after studying this for decades, we know that scattering processes are at the same wavelength, and fluorescence processes have this shift due to the fact that we have an explanation. There's a loss of energy due to the vibrational relaxation, and that fluorescence is at a longer wavelength than the excitation. So it's a different process. Okay, you may not know it's a different process when you're making the measurement in the laboratory, but we can prove it by several things. One of the other things you can do, one of the other mechanisms or means by which you can tell the difference is lifetime. Scattering processes are instantaneous. When I say instantaneous, I think I gave you time frames for the virtual states, and they were on the order of 10 to the minus 15th seconds. Okay? Fluorescence is a much longer-lived process. On the order of 10 to the minus 15th seconds, we barely get the absorption. Okay, it takes a longer time for the fluorescence to manifest itself, and phosphorescence even longer. So we can tell by lifetime. If you really can't measure. I don't know of any way to measure. We don't have the technology to measure processes that occur in that 10 to the minus 15th time frame. In measuring a lifetime, so we can measure a lifetime and tell, it's a millisecond time frame, that's phosphorescence. It's a nanosecond time frame, that's fluorescence. It's on the order of much shorter than picoseconds. I said that fluorescence extends into the picosecond, the upper picosecond range. If it's much shorter than that, it's probably a scattering process. So there's several ways in which you can tell the difference between these processes. Okay, So this is all sort of review. I mentioned synchronous scan spectra, and another way of doing spectra, if I normally fix the excitation and scan the emission, or fix the emission and scan the excitation, then my plot, well, I could do it right there, I guess. Oh, either one, any one of these. My plots, I showed you fixed excitation, scan the emission. Okay? You get this type of a look. If I fix the emission and scan the excitation, my lines would all go this way. Okay? My scans would all be going this way. If I do a synchronous scan, I'm scanning diagonally. Okay, I'm scanning diagonally across this EEM, or diagonally across the. You can't tell with the contour plot. You need the because the contours are filled in afterwards. But it would be a diagonal scan, and it allows you. It usually is used for mixtures. Okay. Sometimes we do experiments and we know we have a pure compound and we want to measure its luminescence, we want to measure its absorption, we want to look at the peaks for that pure compound. But sometimes we have a mixture of compounds and that becomes complicated in absorption spectra and fluorescence and phosphorescence. Becomes complicated because in a mixture, peaks may overlap, and it's even worse with molecular spectroscopy because we have broad peaks, they're likely to overlap. They're very likely to overlap. And so if I run a synchronous scan, I get a little bit better resolution. I'm not exciting everything at its optimum excitation and optimum emission. Okay, in the case of EEMs like this, well, we might go into this and say, okay, I did the EEM of this unknown compound, and now I'm going to make the measurement right here. I know the value of the excitation, and I know the value of the emission, and now I'm going to measure the fluorescence at the optimum. Well, in the case of the synchronous scan, you're not measuring at the optimum, okay? But you are because of the nature of this experiment, you are getting a better resolution or resolution meaning resolution being able to resolve the spectrum of one species from another. And the reason is I'm not doing things at the optimum where maybe they all overlap. Okay, maybe where the emission of each of the molecules overlaps the other one. Now I'm looking at situations that are off the optimum where I may be able to see one but not the other one. And then when I get to the condition, it flips, and I can see the one that I couldn't see before, and the other one its emission dies off. So we can change the selectivity of synchronous scan spectra by selecting the delta, sometimes referred to as the delta lambda. That's what that is, delta lambda. Two Greek letters stuck together. Delta meaning the difference, lambda, of course, difference in wavelength. So the difference between the excitation and emission, I vary that a little bit. Now, if I have a system like, we've done a lot of spectroscopy, a lot of fluorescent spectroscopy of aromatics like salicylic acid. Okay, salicylic acid, benzene ring, carboxylic acid, phenolic group, ortho to each other. Excitation's about 300, emission's about 400. There's a 100 nanometer delta between the optimum excitation and the optimum emission. If I were to fix the excitation at 300 and scan, I actually have a scan in a minute, though, or a similar compound, and you'll get a broad peak. If I were to start the excitation with an emission 100 nanometers greater, okay, I would get a much sharper peak, okay? And the reason I get a sharper peak is because when I get to the optimum emission, or excuse me, when I get to the optimum, in that case, if the delta is 100, and that's the optimum, then I'll still have the optimum when I reach the 300, 400 nanometer maximum wavelength for that molecule. But in all other cases, okay, I will not be at the same excitation wavelength. That's only at 300, 400 will I be at that same excitation wavelength. At every other case, my excitation will just be 300 nanometers shorter than my emission. So what I end up with is I end up with a sharper peak, okay, because of that. And that manifests itself in mixtures as better resolution, getting sharper peaks and being able to resolve one component from another. So synchronous scan spectra, it's not been widely practiced until recent years, and turns out is a pretty good way to resolve spectra of mixtures. Okay, I finished here last class. Why I took so much time reviewing, I'm not sure. Does anybody want to do a presentation today? Okay, I'll do my presentation today then. So that means we're going to see a lot of presentations on Wednesday, because Wednesday's our last class, right? Okay. All right. Fluorescence efficiency or quantum yield. I gave you two terms, and I gave you a definition. Okay, so phi sub f is the quantum yield. Actually, fluorescence efficiency or quantum yield, and you might hear me say quantum efficiency. Well, why not? I'm mixing the terms up. Okay. Is there a difference between those terms? A lot of times they're used interchangeably. I give you a definition of number of photons emitted divided by the number of photons absorbed. Inherently, that means that all photons. Okay. So if what I do to measure this is I measure the fluorescence spectrum, okay, and I integrate the area under the curve. More appropriately, I would do the EEM and I integrate the area under that peak. That's the true quantum yield, because it takes all of the quanta of light that are being absorbed, okay, number of photons absorbed, number of quanta of light absorbed, and then I look at the emission that I get from that absorption. Now, fluorescence efficiency is sometimes defined at a single wavelength. So we just say, at one wavelength of light, what's the percentage or the fraction, of the light that's absorbed versus the light that's emitted as fluorescence. So efficiency is sometimes at a single wavelength. The true quantum yield is integrating over the entire luminescence spectrum. Okay, minor difference. Important, I guess, when it comes to the numbers. If I were able to, if there are compounds where all of the light that's absorbed is re-emitted, at least as good as we can measure, as close as we can measure, we get 100% of the light absorbed, we get it back as emission. That would have a quantum yield equal to 1.0. There are some molecules like some dyes, fluorescein. Fluorescein dye has a quantum yield really close to 1. Rhodamine, beautiful red colored dye, has a quantum efficiency of 1, very close to 1, or you know 0.99 or something like that. So we're getting like all of the light, very efficient absorber re-emitter of that radiation. I said to you a little bit about where the quantum yield comes from in terms of the processes that we talked about in our Jablonski diagram. We said once the absorption occurs, because we got to have absorption, right? We got to have absorption, and to get the excitation, then several things can happen, right? We said several things can happen. What can happen is we can have fluorescence. Okay, we can have internal conversion, coupling of the vibrational levels of the lower state, the ground state, with the excited state, and loss of energy that way. Or we can have inter-system crossing to the triplet state. We can even break these down even more, because remember I said in the inter-system crossing case, two things can happen. Either phosphorescence can happen, or internal conversion in the triplet state can happen. Or actually, three things. It can go back and have delayed fluorescence. Okay. Then in the singlet state, even without inter-system crossing, There are a few things. We said vibrational relaxation occurs, internal conversion, they're collisional things. We could actually write K's for all of those things. Okay? In some places, if you look in some textbooks, they'll list 5, 6, 7 different processes that can occur to the excited state molecule. All of those processes that do not give rise to fluorescence take away from the fluorescence because they are limiting the amount of photons that are emitted, but they're using the photons that are absorbed. So when we look at this, this is a simplified version of it. The quantum yield says I'm going to get back some amount of fluorescence, some rate of fluorescence. That's what the K is supposed to stand for, a rate. And the things that are going to take away, all possible things, including fluorescence, are in the denominator. Okay, the numerator is just fluorescence. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the luminescence, the amount of light given off. And then all kinds of things are involved. Yeah, there's fluorescence involved, but there's also internal conversion or inter-system crossing. And again, we could split out some other things as well. So the rates of these things matter. If I do anything to increase one of the rates, what could I do? Well, temperature is a possibility. Let's see, I have these all listed for you. If I increase temperature, what happens in a molecule when you increase temperature? Vibrations. Okay? More vibrations. So remember I said that internal conversion is the coupling of the upper vibrational levels of the ground state with the vibrational levels of the excited state. Well, when I start to heat things up, those upper vibrational levels become more important, more populated. And it's easier for that internal conversion process to occur. So what happens is fluorescence shows an inverse relationship with temperature, usually. If I heat the molecule up, its fluorescence usually goes down. If I cool the molecule down, its fluorescence goes up. That is based on the rate of internal conversion. The greater the temperature, the greater the rate of internal conversion, that removes energy that would otherwise be given off as fluorescence. Okay, so if I can do something, and this is a problem in fluorescence because most instruments, if you were to do an experiment, and we were involved in a lot of these all-day experiments, 8-hour, 10-hour experiments. I mean, what are graduate students for? To work 10 hours a day. Okay, so we would put the cuvette in the instrument, and we would be doing a series of spectroscopic experiments on the same sample all day, and that sample would get warmer and warmer and warmer, and over time the fluorescence was going down and down, and we said, "What's going on here? Well, fluorescence is decreasing. It shouldn't be doing that. Are we getting photo bleaching and photo degradation?" And then we'd come back the next day, and the fluorescence would be back up where it was the day before. It couldn't have been degradation. Okay, so what happened? Well, it was just heating of the sample in the sample compartment. The sample compartment was getting warm by the xenon arc lamp. That xenon arc lamp, you know, who needs a tanning booth? Okay, that thing puts out some energy, and it's hot, and it's giving off ozone, and the light impinging on the sample is warming the sample a few degrees. You know, a few degrees over the course of a day, and you see a decrease in the fluorescence. So that is the sort of importance of that system. Again, understanding the process is going to help us make better measurements. We begin to understand that heating of the sample was causing a decrease in fluorescence. What do? We just thermostated the system. We just hooked up a constant temperature bath, put a sample holder in there that had water circulating through it, from a constant temperature bath, and problem solved. Okay, so we need to understand that in order to make better measurements. Okay, I mentioned lifetime fluorescence. Lifetimes, I talked about them before, nanosecond, picosecond, lifetimes, and it's inverse related to that rate of fluorescence. Makes sense. I hope it makes sense. Okay, so anything affecting any of these rates involved in the photophysical process will affect the quantum yield. And I mentioned the temperature increase. Heating of the solution can be a problem. Okay. Quantitative analysis by fluorescence spectroscopy involves Beer's law, because Beer's law was the absorption situation. So, hopefully you got that right on the exam. I think most people did. I asked you for this. Okay, I was looking for a Beer's law expression that had I0 in it. Somebody left the log out. Okay, forgot to take the logarithm. But at any rate, Beer's law is involved because there's absorption. Let's look at this equation first. What's going on? Well, light's passing through the sample, and some of the light's absorbed and some of it goes right on through and is transmitted. That's this term right here, I0 minus I. Okay? I take the light that comes from the source and the light that ends up going right through the sample, transmitted through the sample. I subtract them and I find out how much light was absorbed by the sample. Okay, that's simple. Then I multiply that times the quantum yield, because it was the quantum yield that tells me how much of that light is converted into the luminescence process that I'm interested in. So I multiply that times the quantum yield, and that should give me my fluorescence, except for one thing. When I make the measurement, am I measuring all of the light that's emitted by the analyte molecule, by the species of interest? Well, no, actually I have a detector over here and it's only getting a small fraction of the light. The light's emitted 360 degrees. Think of the molecule as a point source. It gets excited and it emits light in a sphere all directions. Okay, it becomes excited and it gives out not like scattering where sometimes the forward scattering is more than the back scattering and so forth. It's not that way with fluorescence or phosphorescence. It becomes a source unto itself. It takes the energy, goes to the excited state, the electron comes back down, emits equally in all directions, 360 degrees around a sphere. But I've only got a little detector sitting over here that's measuring the light coming off in one direction. So all that other light is lost. If I bring my detector closer to the sample, okay, and my detector maybe detects light in a, you know, in a region, right? That photomultiplier tube has a region on the face of it where light can go in and be detected. If I'm way out here, more of that light is the light spreads as it goes away, and I lose more light. If I bring the detector closer, I get a little bit more energy. If I do fancy things like put mirrors around the sample and reflect as much light to the detector, I get a little bit more light. K is an instrument factor. Depends on your instrument. Depends on how you designed your instrument or how your manufacturer designed your instrument. So the fluorescence intensity is related to those things that I talked about, transmitted source intensity minus transmitted intensity, which means the light absorbed, times the fluorescence quantum efficiency, if we're only dealing with one wavelength, it's efficiency and not overall quantum yield. And then there's this instrumental factor, and every instrument's different. Okay, every instrument's different because of the design of the instrument, the distance. I only talked to you about the distance of the source from the sample as a logical example of one major factor that is going to influence the amount of light that we collect in our experiment. Okay? So this is the actual fluorescence quantitative equation. Since we know Beer's law deals with this part of the equation, I'm kind of messy here. With this part of the equation, we get that from Beer's law, and we know what Beer's law is. Okay, this is one form of it. This is another form of Beer's law. Okay, then we can substitute Beer's law into this fluorescence equation, and we get this thing, this ugly mess. Now, this ugly mess tells me all the same things. My fluorescence is due to some instrumental factor, the quantum yield or quantum efficiency if I'm only working at one wavelength, the amount of light coming from my source. The more light you get from your source, the more excited states you get and the more fluorescence you get. So source intensity is very important. And then this whole Beer's Law thing for absorption, for the absorption part of it. Now, it's ugly. It's got E in there, and then it's got epsilon BC, E raised to the negative epsilon BC power. And it's 1 minus E to the minus epsilon BC power. So, what happens? Well, this actually gives you a series expansion, okay? It's not a simple equation. It gives you a series expansion that has several terms, okay, raised to the n power, where n is an integer, 1, 2, 3, so you get several bunch of these terms, and you can write them out forever if you'd like, but they become insignificant. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I have this on here. Yeah, there it is. For epsilon BC less than 0.5, 0.05, I said that wrong. Epsilon BC, of course, is absorbance. So for absorbances less than 0.05 absorbance units, all of the other terms in the series expansion are neglected, and you can just use fluorescence as this simple equation. And it's simple because what's K? It's some factor you don't know the value of, so it's just a proportionality constant. What's phi? Well, a lot of times you don't know phi, unless you're going to look it up in a book or something. What's I0? Well, we rarely ever measure it and write it down and say, okay, here's I0. And molar absorptivity? Again, seldom do we measure it. B is usually fixed. So all of these things just turn out to be a proportionality constant relating fluorescence to concentration. And if I keep my absorbances below 0.05 absorbance units at the wavelength that I'm interested in, then I have a simple equation relating fluorescence to concentration. The key here is fluorescence is complementary to molecular absorption. That's why we're studying them together. That's one reason why we're studying them together. Secondly, it uses a lot of the same instrumentation or instrumental components. And so it's complementary. I'm going to do fluorescence at low concentration where the absorbances are below 0.05 if I don't want to have a messy series expansion type equation that governs the... The series expansion is not a straight line. It's a curve. Okay, and so if I don't want to have a curve and I don't want to deal with that mess, I keep my absorbances below 0.05 and everything will be fine. For absorbance, I probably want to work above 0.05 because getting down at 0.05 is a low value, and I may have trouble measuring low values, so I want to be at high values. So the two techniques are very complementary. Absorbance for higher concentrations, fluorescence for low trace level concentrations. Okay, moving right along. Oh, note dependence on. Okay, so quantum yield's important, or fluorescence efficiency important is important. Some things have inherently low fluorescence efficiencies. I mentioned already the source intensity is very important. If you have an intense source, you may get better fluorescence. You should get better fluorescence based on the equation. However, I got to worry about photo bleaching, photo degradation of the sample. I haven't told you this story yet, so I'll tell you now. The most impressive experiment I ever saw with photo bleaching is somebody took a cuvette with a dye in it that was easily photo degraded, and they shone a laser on it. I don't even remember what wavelength it was, but I think it was a UV laser. And the laser hit the face of the cuvette and bleached the color out of the dye. It was a blue dye in a solution. And the laser beam hit the face of the cuvette and went through. And as it went through, over the course of a few seconds, it bleached the blue color right out of the solution. And left behind was a cuvette with a blue solution in it, but there was a hole in the solution. A clear hole going through the solution because it was bleached from blue to clear. And then, of course, you turn the laser off and you wait a couple of minutes, or even less than a minute, maybe, and the molecules move around and the hole goes away. And then you turn the laser back on and you bleach another hole in it. Okay? Now, that's only there to illustrate the fact that high-intensity sources give you greater fluorescence, but they also give you greater possibility of photodegradation or bleaching of the sample, and you got to be careful when you're doing those kinds of experiments. So, intensity is important, quantum yield is important, molar absorptivity. Now, molar absorptivity and quantum yield are related to one another, right? Because you got to have molar absorptivity. It's the absorbance that gives you the denominator of that equation. Okay, the numerator is the part that is the quantum part of it, right? How much is returned back to you and not lost in some by some other process. So molar absorptivity is to absorbance as quantum yield is to fluorescence, but you need the molar absorptivity in the first place. And then, of course, path length is important as well as it is in absorbance measurements also. Okay, let me talk to you about the 0.05 number. Okay, the 0.05 number comes about because of what are referred to as interfilter effects. Remember when we talked about filters, optical filters, and we said, you know, you can have a glass, piece of glass, colored glass, or I showed you a little piece of gelatin, you know, it was like jello gelatin with all the water squeezed out, okay? And I said you could also use colored solutions, okay? So you could put a solution in the light path and it would absorb light and cut out wavelengths you don't want or whatever. Well, what if your sample itself absorbs radiation and filters the light? Okay. What if the absorbance of the sample is so high that it absorbs the source intensity so you have a cuvette and the light hits it and it absorbs the source intensity at the front of the cuvette and absorbs all the light? Then the poor molecules in the back don't get any light. Okay, that's our problem today. We don't get enough light for freezing. Right, it's cold here, right? Because we don't get enough solar energy. Well, that's a different reason. But the light, we have an inner filter effect. If the sample absorbs the light that you're trying to measure the wavelength that's going to give rise to fluorescence. So an inner filter effect is where the sample filters out the light and therefore doesn't give rise to the process, the fluorescence process or phosphorescence process that we're trying to measure. That's what this 0.05 is about. If you, above 0.05 absorbance units, the guys in the back are not the molecules, I'm talking molecules, okay? The guys in the back are not getting the light, okay? The light from the source is hitting the molecules in the front of the cuvette, and they're absorbing it all, or absorbing most of it, and the guys in the back are just getting a little bit of light. Okay, that's interfilter effect. So 0.05 turns out to be a value where it doesn't make a difference. There's enough light for everybody to give rise to the fluorescence, and it doesn't cause a problem. And that's what this whole series expansion and why fluorescence doesn't really give rise to a linear relationship, particularly at higher concentrations or higher absorbances. Now, when we think about this, we realize that there's two kinds of interfilter effects that can occur, and they're listed here for you. Since I have an excitation wavelength in fluorescence that excites the energy, if I absorb that, I'm not going to get excited states. And so any absorption of the excitation energy is going to reduce the number of excited states I get and going to reduce the fluorescence. And it's going to reduce it in a funny way because things in the front of the cuvette are going to get fully illuminated and fully excited, and things in the back side of the cuvette are not going to get fully illuminated and are not going to get fully excited, not going to get as many excited states generated. That's the primary interfilter effect because we're dealing with the excitation energy, the thing that starts the trouble in the first place. Then we have the secondary interfilter effect. That's when the emitted radiation, the fluorescence or phosphorescence that we're trying to measure, that emitted radiation is absorbed and doesn't get to the detector because even though the molecules are acting as point sources and giving out light in all directions, the light never makes it all the way through the solution to the detector, or is cut down, is attenuated, reduced in intensity before it reaches the detector. That would be the secondary interfilter effect. Okay? So, primary is excitation energy being absorbed and not allowing us to get the full fluorescence. Secondary interfilter effect is the emitted radiation being absorbed and not giving us the full fluorescence. Okay? These are not, in my personal opinion, should not be referred to as quenching. Okay? Some people call it interfilter quenching or light quenching or something like that. It's not really quenching. I'll tell you later what quenching is. Okay? And it's just a sore point with me because we've done a lot of work with quenching, other types of quenching phenomenon. And this is an interfilter effect. This is an absorption process. It's not a process. You think of quenching. I think of quenching as something existed and then it was quenched. It was put out. Well, this doesn't exist in the first place because the molecules are not able to generate that light in the first place. Okay. Here's my little diagram with my cuvette. Okay, so we're doing our experiment. We got a cuvette and light's coming in, I0. But this this demonstrates for us the primary interfilter effect because and what this is supposed to represent is reduced intensity. Okay, so I should be getting intensity up here because the light should be absorbed and transmitted through the sample. And if I'm doing this properly, only a little bit of the light is absorbed, and the amount that is transmitted is still quite large. But what happens in the interfilter or primary interfilter case is that light is cut way down. So, remember, fluorescence is done at a right angle. So we're facing the sample, the cuvette. The light's passing through this way, but we would be observing the fluorescence. And what we would see, is it would be very bright over here. The fluorescence that is generated would be very bright over here and would be very weak over here because of the amount of excitation energies being absorbed as the light traverses the sample. Does that make sense? Okay. Front part of cells illuminated more. Okay, blah, blah, blah. It's all there. Ooh, I didn't mean to skip to. Interfilter effect conclusions. Interfiltering results in curved calibration curves. Okay? So, can I compensate for that curve? Or do I know what the curve means? Yes, we do. That series expansion that I gave you, where, with a E 1 minus E to the minus epsilon BC, that actually describes the curve perfectly. If you're able to know all of the parameters, then that series expansion describes exactly what is going on with the interfilter effect. So we know exactly what's there, but turns out it's very hard to measure or to know all of those parameters. And as an analytical chemist, I don't want to have to know all those things. I want to be able to just take a sample, slap it in the instrument, and get a measurement, and know that it's directly related to concentration, and not have some complicated equation that governs the relationship between concentration and fluorescence. So I know the relationship. That curved calibration curve is given by I sub F is equal to K times phi times all those other things that are in the equation, okay? And I gave you the equation. So we know it, but it's difficult to use. Must know or measure the absorbance at both the excitation and emission wavelength. This is true of every fluorescence measurement you make. You need to know that the fluorescence is low enough that it's not causing you a problem. You say, what if I have a fluorescence instrument, but I don't have an absorption instrument to measure the absorption? That's okay. What you can do is you can dilute the sample. You can measure the sample and get the fluorescence. Then you can dilute it and measure the fluorescence. Dilute it again and measure the fluorescence. Do a series of dilutions. If it falls on a straight line, there's no problem. Your highest measurement was a measurement with no interfilter effect, because the inner filter effect should be diluted out as you dilute the sample. So you keep diluting the sample down, and if everything falls on a straight line, there's no problem with the inner filter effect. Okay? And you don't need an absorption instrument to make that measurement. But if you have one, you should measure the absorbance at the excitation wavelength for primary inner filter effect and at the emission wavelength for secondary inner filter effect. Let's see, the third one on my list, fluorescence, is basically a trace technique. Okay, I told you this already. It's complementary to absorbance. So it's 1 to 3 orders of magnitude lower in detection limit than absorbance. Well, that's good. Fluorescence. Now, why would that be? There's less light involved. I shine light on the sample, and a very tiny amount of it comes out. It turns out that it's easier to measure that little tiny light amount of light in the background of nothing, right? With no, in the absence of light, it's easy to measure a tiny amount of light than it is to measure absorbance, which is the ratio of source intensity and transmitted intensity. In other words, when I measure source intensity and transmitted intensity, I'm measuring two large numbers. Right? I'm measuring the amount of light coming from the source, and I'm measuring the amount of light transmitted through the sample. Those could be very large numbers, two large numbers. And they could be very similar to each other if there's little absorbance in the sample. That turns out to be harder to measure low concentrations, because low concentrations give rise to low absorbance. And therefore, I0 and I are almost the same. If I have a little bit of noise in I0 and I can't tell the difference between them. It's hard to measure low concentrations with absorbance. However, in the fluorescence case, I shine the light, and then I look at the fluorescence at a right angle. So I'm not interfered with by the source intensity. I0 doesn't cause me a problem. I can just measure I, or I sub F, as we called it, the fluorescence intensity, in the background of nothing. So I can measure a low light level fairly accurately. I have a hard time measuring the difference between two large numbers. So fluorescence is a trace technique, and it gives us much lower detection limits than absorption. Upper limit of fluorescence occurs around the lower limit of absorbance. Inner filter effect is sometimes called quenching, but we don't like that name. Okay. Let me talk to you about the excited state chemistry. I'm excited about excited state chemistry. Okay. When an excited state is formed, it's a special entity. It's a special case of a I sat in a thesis dissertation defense on Wednesday, and I don't often think about isotope chemistry, but the dissertation was on stable isotope chemistry. Nitrogen has an atomic mass. Or an atomic mass of 14, but sometimes you have an extra, but there are nitrogen atoms that have an extra a neutron in them, and it's nitrogen 15, right? So we have isotopes. But we say, oh, we don't worry about them because they're chemically the same as the two isotopes are chemically the same as each other, right? They form the same kind of bonds, they undergo the same kind of reactions and so forth, right? Most of the time, 99% of the time, 99.9% of the time. But there are slight differences because of that extra neutron. All right? Now, by analogy, I'm bringing this up to make an analogy. When I have a molecule and I shine light on it and it goes to the excited state, it's the same molecule, right? It didn't change. It's still the same molecule. There's nothing different about it. Well, actually, there's something different about it. The electron's not where it was before. So actually, the excited state is a chemical entity that's slightly different than the ground state atom. Although it's the same molecule, we draw its structure the same. What's the difference? The difference is the electron's not in the same place as it was before. And therefore, it does things differently. As a matter of fact, because that electron is often involved in bonding reactions or holding atoms of the molecule together, I already told you that if I promote that electron too high and it leaves, the molecule may fall apart. And so therefore we have photo bleaching or photo degradation or those kinds of effects. And we observe them in... my wife made me buy a new couch. Okay, because the couch in our house sat in front of a big window where the sun would shine in. And it had a beautiful flowery print on it that just faded and faded and faded over time because it just sat there. The couch is in perfect condition. I never even sit on the couch. Okay, it's like silly me. It's like a thing I look at, but I never sit on it. Okay, the couch was in perfect condition. I couldn't bear to throw it out. I have it in the garage. Okay, but in perfect condition, except the flowery print on it is faded. Okay, and it was kind of red, and now it's pink. And that's photodegradation, right? We observe that effect. Okay. Excited state molecules are different chemical entities than ground state molecules. They can undergo photodegradation or photochemistry. They can also just undergo different kinds of reactions. So, let's see. Sometimes the fluorescence and the phosphorescence are complicated by the fact that the molecule is different in the excited state than it is in the ground state. Now, I have here chemical reactions. The excited state can undergo chemical reactions that the ground state can't. And I said dyes fade, sunlight, my couch. Okay, and then hopefully you'll remember that, right? In photo decomposition is a big problem. The experiment with the laser beam bleaching the hole in the sample. What if I was trying to use that laser and that dye and I wanted to make a measurement? All I'm doing is every time I turn the laser on, I'm bleaching a hole in the sample. I can't do anything. I'm stuck. All right. Here's some examples here. So the first example is photo decomposition. All right. Second one is acid-base chemistry. It turns out, I ran into this while I was in graduate school, I was measuring the some molecules. I wasn't actually measuring. I was measuring aromatics, and the phenolate, the phenol, okay, phenol, or some people like to say phenol, is actually that proton on there actually has some acidity. But it turns out, as we all know from organic chemistry, that pKa of that hydrogen is about 10. Okay, the pKa of a aromatic OH group, a phenolic OH, is around 10. Okay, however, it turns out for phenol, when I excite that molecule, when I hit it with like 300 nanometer radiation or something in that neighborhood, all of a sudden the structure the structure changes. Why? Because some of the electrons are promoted to an excited state. And the electronic structure in the molecule changes. And all of a sudden, it's the electronic structure that governs how acidic that proton is, whether it's able to come off or not come off at certain pH values. It turns out that in the excited state, that proton becomes much more acidic. Okay, it is more readily able to come off by how many orders of magnitude? 6 orders of magnitude difference. That's big. That's big time. That's a million times different. Okay, the ability of that proton to come off changes just because I shine light on the molecule. Who would have guessed that it changed so much? I didn't guess. I stumbled across this because I was trying to measure pKa's by a fluorescence experiment. And you can do that. You can change pH and monitor the fluorescence and see the see a titration curve, just like you do with a pH electrode or anything else, a potentiometric titration curve, a sigmoidal-shaped curve. But it turns out that if the molecule undergoes some kind of excited state chemistry, that pKa that you get is some kind of an average between the ground state molecules and the excited state molecules. And that's what I was seeing. I was seeing a shift from the correct value that was known in the literature for these molecules and the value that I was measuring by my photochemical experiment. So in the excited state, we got, in some cases, we have acid-base chemistry going on that changes ground state to excited state. Let me mention to you some other things that occur for excited states. Okay, I mentioned chemical reactions occur for excited states. But energy transfer can occur in excited states as well. So it says here, effects on the solute other than excited state emission, radiationless stuff. Stuff that occurs to that excited state molecule that gives rise to loss of energy without emitting fluorescence. All right. So I'm going to call this real quenching. This is real quenching, not interfilter effect, not loss of light in the primary case, not giving you the excited state, but actual excited state is attained, but it doesn't give rise to luminescence, or we lose the luminescence because of some process, some quenching process. The first one I have here is energy transfer. So, A is the analyte species, okay? And when it's excited, I put a little star next to it, okay? My little star. And the one in front of it tells me that it's a singlet state, all right? So, A, excited state singlet, excited with a little star, and one tells me it's a singlet. A quencher comes along, okay, something Q, and robs the energy. There's a transfer of energy, all right? And A ends up in the ground state, and now Q is in the excited singlet state. Q may or may not fluoresce, okay? May not luminesce. Another way of looking at this is, what if we take A and Q and we form a complex? Okay, maybe we form a complex in the excited state only, all right? Because of that, some change in the molecule or whatever, and it forms in the excited state. A excited singlet A with an asterisk, a little star there, excited state binds together with Q to form an AQ complex. Now the complex is excited, but the complex may or may not give rise to the same emission, luminescence, fluorescence, whatever, that we saw before. And so we can possibly get quenching in that case. So the processes are Q absorbs the emission A, that might be sort of the first case, or in the second case, collision or a non-radiative transfer of energy, and it follows the Stern-Volmer law. Okay, what's the Stern-Volmer law? I'm so glad you asked. The Stern-Volmer equation is this equation here, and all it says is that the species has a fluorescence efficiency or a quantum yield that we talked about, but it may not be giving off light according to its normally published quantum yield. And so the ratio of that quantum yield, let's say in the absence of the quencher, okay? So this would be in the absence of the quencher. I don't have that defined anywhere. Oh, maybe I do. Here it is. Fluorescence quantum yield in the absence of the quencher. Fluorescence quantum yield with the quencher, okay? It follows this law. There's some kind of a K that determines quenching, a lifetime, and the concentration of the quencher. So it's 1 plus the product of the reaction. Now, what's K? Well, K could be like in the previous slide. Sorry. If I'm forming a complex, then K would be the products over the reactants. Whoops, that's supposed to be Q. Okay, so it's just a mass action type of equilibrium constant. So that's what K is. And tau is the fluorescence lifetime, and Q is the quencher. Realizing that lifetime is important, particularly if it's a collisional process, right? If I have a long-lived fluorophore, it's more likely to get collided with and lose its fluorescence. If it's short-lived, oh, just flash of light, and nothing can collide with it in that time frame, or it's less likely unless we increase the concentrations really high, and there's all sorts of collisions going on because there's lots of molecules in there. Okay, two types of quenching are covered by the Stern-Volmer equation: static quenching or dynamic quenching. Dynamic is the collisional one. Okay, we're bumper cars. We're driving around and we're bumping into each other. And if we bump into the one with the energy, we rob the energy from it, and it doesn't give off light. So that's collisional quenching. Static quenching is where a dark complex is formed. And I sort of slid right over this in the previous slide because I knew there's two kinds of quenching. And Stern-Volmer covers both of them, although the K value is different. In the case of collisional quenching, has to do with the amount of collisions or the rate of collisions. The K in the static quenching involves the ability of A and Q to get together, their equilibrium constant, so to speak. And so if a complex is formed, but the complex is a dark complex, in other words, the complex, maybe A fluoresces fine, but when it gets together with Q, there's internal conversion or intersystem crossing or some other process that dissipates the energy as heat is the normal explanation and doesn't give energy as light. We want light. We want to see light as fluorescence or phosphorescence, but we lost it because of the complex that was formed. Okay, so those two kinds of quenching are covered by Stern-Volmer. Okay? Stern was a person and Volmer was a person, and they got together and they made the Stern-Volmer law.
In the experiment,
either one's fine. Okay, it could be that in my dissertation work, okay, I added quenchers. Okay, I was quenching things, but it could be something that's naturally present. It could be oxygen. Oxygen quenches. Okay? And so you may find that I measured the fluorescence of something and there's no fluorescence. Or it's very limited. What's the problem? It may be that the oxygen is dissolved in the solution, okay, and it's quenching the fluorescence. It's an impurity.
But in this case, when it is a first time when we measured, we don't have the impurity concentration.
Right.
It acts as a quencher. So then, determine the concentration of quenching.
Yeah, you'd have to independently determine it. If you wanted to use the Stern-Volmer equation, you would have to independently measure the quencher. You'd have to know what it was and have a way to measure it, and then be able to plug it into this equation to determine that quenching. Okay. Down here, by the way, it says, no matter what type of quenching you have, it's increasing the rate of radiationless deactivation in some way. Normally, in the static case, that's the way we think about it. In dynamic, it's just an energy transfer. Oh, quenching constant, fluorescence lifetime, okay. Yeah, all right, we talked about that. Here's an example, generated by Mike Hayes, one of my graduate students, back in 1996. Excuse me. He measured the fluorescence quenching of fulvic acid with copper. Okay, so he went out to the river and grabbed a sample of Merrimack River water. Okay, I don't really know where he got it from, but he came up with a sample that had natural organic compounds in it, the brown yellow stuff that's in the water. Why is the swamp have brown water in it? Natural organic compounds, things called fulvic acid or humic acid. Okay, so he took this sample and he happened to know that this sample had 15 milligrams per liter of fulvic acid in it, of this compound, and he added copper at various amounts. Now, I didn't give you the legend, so you don't know what A, B, C, D, or E are, but they're various concentrations of copper ion that he added. Turns out copper forms a complex with the fulvic acid, forms a metal ligand complex. And that is a dark complex, or a reduced fluorescence efficiency complex. And so he saw this phenomenon. A was with no copper added. zero, we don't even have units here, millimolar copper, okay? And then B, C, D, E were increasing concentrations of copper, okay? This is the fluorescence. Guess what that is? That's the Raman band of H2O. Guess what this is? Technically, it's... How do you spell Rayleigh scattering? Something like that. Okay? So you see several things in the fluorescence spectrum. That's not fluorescence. That's not fluorescence. This is. Okay? This is where the fluorescence action is. All right? That's true quenching. All right? And this is just a version of the Stern-Volmer equation that we saw before. This is the Ryan equation, named after me. I named it after myself. I'm trying to make myself famous, okay? And here's what happens. All I'm looking at is, I'm looking at the intensity of light that I would see in the absence of the quencher, and the intensity of light that I see with the quencher, and the difference between those is the amount that's quenched. Okay, and that's related to that quenching constant, some K value, times the concentration of the quencher, which in the case I just showed you was metal, M equals copper. Okay, in this equation, it's a similar thing. What the problem is that the Stern-Volmer equation only works for systems where there's complete quenching. Where it's either on or it's off, where the molecule either fluoresces or it doesn't fluoresce. So my equation tells me that, or tells us that it's possible that the efficiency of fluorescence can be reduced, but not reduced to zero. So I can have that complex go from a maximum. The quencher, the analyte molecule, go from a maximum fluorescence. Then when it forms the complex, it goes to some lower fluorescence, but maybe not zero. Okay, so it's still giving off light, but not as much as it was when it was not quenched. So the idea here is intensity in the absence of the quencher, intensity with the quencher, that tells me how much is quenched, and then intensity in the absence and intensity with the maximum, this would be like Imax, I guess you could call it. All right? When you've quenched the maximum amount, but there's still some fluorescence obtained. We've made all of the copper fulvic acid complexes, and they still fluoresce. All fulvic acid is present as a complex, but it still gives off some fluorescence. Okay? That difference between the maximum and the minimum, so there's a maximum and a minimum, but minimum is not zero. So now I've defined the range over which I can have quenching, and then in the top part of the equation tells me how much is quenched. That relates to the total concentration and the amount that I formed. So in other words, the ability to form, and it's called L because it was copper 2+ plus the fulvic acid yields a copper fulvic acid complex. So C sub L is the total amount of ability of that ligand to bind, and ML is the amount of this that I've formed, because there's an equilibrium here, right, governed by a K value. And so we use that to determine equilibrium constants. And you mix it, you combine it with a mass action equilibrium constant and mass balance equations, and you get these really ugly equations that allow you to measure binding based on quenching. Okay? I know, you're excited. I can tell. You get quenching curves that look like this, all right? And you can fit those equations that I showed you to these curves to allow you to determine equilibrium constants and so forth. All right. You can do that for lots of different things, not everything, but things that quench. So we did work with copper, cobalt, manganese, and then we got to aluminum, and instead of quenching, it enhanced. It increased. Now, the thing that was good about the Ryan equation is that it, Stern-Volmer only covers quenching. And it only covers cases where the quenching goes to zero. In my case, I said I covered non-zero. I originally developed the equation for non-zero quenching, where you get quenching, but it just reduced the amount of intensity. Then I found out that there were cases where we had enhancement, and the equation works for those too. Okay, you can measure the ability of a substance to change its fluorescence efficiency to higher values when you form a complex. And aluminum was such a case with this natural organic matter that we were looking at. Okay, so this just shows you original curve with zero aluminum, final curve with more aluminum. You'll notice that that it's not at the same wavelength, it's at a slightly different wavelength. So the question is, it's a shift in wavelength, but there's an enhancement, and I don't want to get into it. This is just an EEM that shows you that there's a shift. It was over here, now it moved over here. And it also manifests itself as not a straight... It didn't follow the original equation, so I had to develop an equation for two sites. It turns out there were two different things going on in the system. All right, and I'm not going to really spend much time on that. Okay, let me just. I have to answer a question for you. Let's see, or ask you a question.